This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for your help in this fall 2010 fundraiser for KUAF. Remember, the quicker we hit our goal, the sooner this fundraiser is over. It is not often that a book about serious science captivates a massive, widespread national audience. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot is such a book. The book is about an African-American woman who had cervical cancer, had tissue removed from her without her knowledge in 1951, and cells from that tissue continue to grow and be used in research. Henrietta Lacks' cells were pivotal in developing a polio vaccine and allowing scientists to learn more about cancer and were instrumental in gene mapping. Many of those advances took place decades after Henrietta Lacks had died. The cells, called HeLa cells, He for Henrietta, La for Lacks, still live today and are still used in a variety of research capacities. There is science in the book, but we also meet Henrietta Lacks' family. They didn't know about her cells' legacy for years, and the book launches serious conversations about medical ethics, race, social class, and privacy. Rebecca Skloot will discuss her book at several venues in the area, including a pair of events open to the public over the next 2 days. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks is this year's selection for One Book, One Community in Fayetteville and at the University of Arkansas. Tonight, she'll deliver a public lecture in the auditorium at Donald W. Reynolds Center for Enterprise Development at 7 o'clock. That's on the University of Arkansas campus. Tomorrow night, she'll speak at 7 in the Walker Community Room of the Fayetteville Public Library. That event is open to the public, but seating is limited. In between the public talks, she'll be talking to thousands of students on the University of Arkansas campus. Rebecca Skloot first heard about Henrietta Lacks when she was 16, a brief mention in a science class that Rebecca was taking. A few years later, she began her thoroughly researched book, a process that would take her more than 10 years to finish. Yesterday, I asked Rebecca Skloot if in the middle of researching and writing and rewriting the book, she ever feared she would never finish.
Oh, yeah, there were certainly days where I felt like I might be working on this book until I was in my 90s. It's funny, people often ask me if I ever felt like giving up, and I didn't. It never crossed my mind to stop, but I certainly did worry at certain points that it would take me forever.
There's serious science in the book, from details of Henrietta's condition that killed her in 1951 to many of the latest developments regarding the HeLa cells and research. Were you thinking about writing for a general audience as you were writing about the science?
Oh, absolutely. I thought a lot about my target audience, and in some ways I set myself up for what seemed to be a kind of an impossible task, which is that I wanted absolutely anyone to be able to read the book. I wanted, you know, the Lacks family, who, you know, the central characters of the story, who don't have a lot of education, who have no background in science whatsoever. I wanted them to be able to read the book, and anyone else who was in a similar situation, so that they could really understand science and come away from the book knowing a lot about the cells and what had happened to them and not being bored by it or sort of left behind in any of the science discussions. But at the same time, I wanted, you know, on the far other end of the spectrum, I wanted Nobel Prize winning, you know, researchers to be able to read the science and the rest of the book without feeling like I was oversimplifying things or without them getting bored and feeling like I had was sort of talking down to them. So I spent a lot of time thinking about this range of readers and trying to write in a way that was accessible to everyone.
That sounds like a serious amount of rewrites.
It was. And a lot of how I did it was I had readers who I would send portions of the book to as I was working on it, who sort of represented the range of people who I was trying to reach. And they would read it and send things back to me. And, you know, on one end of the spectrum, someone who had no interest in science whatsoever would sit, you know, read a part and say, oh, I skipped this part. This was too boring or something. And then my challenge to myself was to go back and say, okay, how can I make them not skip that part? You know, how can I make that more accessible? So I'm a heavy rewriter. The first draft of my book was about twice as long as the final text, and that's sort of how I write. I write very long, and then I condense, and I condense, and I condense. And, for me, the rewriting process, part of that is condensing, is making it more accessible and readable to people. So yeah, I think I rewrote the book beginning to end probably at least 5 or 6 times once I had a final draft.
And your writing does make it accessible, as does your opportunity to visit, first meet, then visit and travel with Deborah, Henrietta's daughter. She's such a, I don't know, she's so fascinating to read about.
Yeah. Yeah, she's an incredible character. I've never met anyone like her. Really complicated character. You know, there were moments where she was terrified and almost paranoid because of all of the things that she'd been through. But she was the most resilient, strong woman I had ever met. And there were times when, you know, she would really... she would worry that maybe I was lying to her. Maybe I wasn't a writer. Maybe someone had sent me to steal her cells to do research on them, which out of the context of the story sounds a little crazy, but within the context of what her family went through, it actually makes a lot of sense. Things like that actually happened to them. I think one of the things that was so incredible about her is that she would have these moments where she would not trust me, or, you know, she would push me away. I mean, at one point, she literally physically threw me up against a wall. And then she would very quickly come back and say, okay, I'm sorry. I know this is not about you. This is part of the story of what happened to me because of all this, you know, the cells. So we have to keep going. And I know all of this needs to be in the book. And she was so incredibly aware of everything that was going on with her and wanted so badly to learn. She would carry a basic dictionary around with her wherever we went and look up, you know, pretty basic same words so that she was sure to understand everything that's going on. That was really, it's just sort of inspiring to watch.
There are wonderful personal moments in the book that you write about. Two that come to mind is one when Deborah and her brother go meet a researcher at Johns Hopkins who wants to, he had already created some artwork that was inspired by Henrietta Sells. And then they meet him and he's patient and he talks to them about what these cells have done, how they've helped in development of polio vaccine. And then another time is when you and Deborah, trying to find out what happened to her older sister who had been institutionalized, and you come upon this sort of aging institution, and the one person you can find who might have any knowledge of records says, well, we're not going to find anything out about her. And then, lo and behold, you know, there's the records and her sister's picture.
Yeah.
It's a touching moment.
Yeah, those two moments, I mean, those two stories are really, I think, some of the most powerful ones in the story. And that one where we went to the hospital where her sister had been institutionalized, and I mean, it really, there are moments in the story where Deborah has always believed that her mother's soul was alive in these cells, and she, once she let me in and started trusting me, she really came to believe that Henrietta was sort of guiding the whole process, that she picked me at a young age and said, here, go over here and study science, and then go over here and study writing, and, you know, learn about these cells when you're 16 so that you'll go on to write this book. And so Deborah had this sense that Henrietta was always sort of out there guiding this. And when we showed up at that institution and we went into the room, and, you know, between the 50s when Deborah's sister was in this institution and the day we went there, there were thousands and thousands of patients who were seen in this hospital. And many of the records of these patients were destroyed. And so when we got there and he started saying, you know, we don't have any of the records from that era. They were all damaged and destroyed, you know. And then he said, well, we do have a few that remained. And the fact that hers were in there was so improbable. The number out of the thousands and thousands of records that hers were there and that they had a photograph in them. The guy who had found those records for us said, I've never seen a photograph in any of these records in all of my decades working here. So there was something that was so astonishing about that, the fact that they remained. And for Deborah, that was very much part of the almost mystical the mystical side of the story of the HeLa cells, which is that, you know, she really believed her mother had been protecting those records and wanted us to find them. And things like that happened throughout the story. And in some ways, the story of the scientist who came along and wanted to share with family the cells, I think she believed the same of him. So he contacted me after reading a magazine article that I'd written about the cells and the family, a very short article, and he said, what I hear from scientists all the time now, which is essentially, oh my God, I worked with these cells every day in my lab. I did my dissertation on these cells. I feel like I owe a lot of my career to these cells, but I never once stopped to wonder where they came from or whether she'd given permission or whether she had a family who cared. And he really wanted to reach out to them. So he did. He created this picture of Henrietta's DNA that he wanted to give to them, which was absolutely beautiful, and then invited them to come to his lab. And it's sort of, I think, one of the things that was amazing to me about him in him sort of appearing in the middle of the story to do this with the family was that that was what they needed more than anything, right? Mm-hmm. They'd been fighting for so many years to get information, particularly from someone at Hopkins. And, you know, they didn't know the cells had been taken until about 25 years after Henrietta's death, when scientists began doing research on her children to learn about the cells. And when the kids would ask questions about the cells and what they were and what did it mean they were alive, they just couldn't get any answers. So in the end, to have a young scientist can say, here, come in my lab. I will teach you what you need to know. Here's my cell phone number so you can call me if you have questions ever. That was something they needed very badly.
And especially
that was all part of the story.
Especially Deborah's brother.
Yeah.
Who had had such a horrible upbringing and was so angry. And for someone to pay attention to him and respect him and talk to him, that was very important.
Yeah, and it had never happened before. He was, in particular, I think of all the children, in some ways they all suffered a lot with Henrietta's death, but he was a newborn. She was pregnant with him when she found the tumor. And so he grew up having no mother and was horribly abused by the people who came along to help with the children after her death. He had a very difficult life and in and out of jail and murdered someone. I mean, he was so angry, and so much of that was because of the loss of his mother. And in those moments, I mean, he softened in a way that no one had ever seen, because this, for him, was in his closest thing to meeting his mother he'd ever seen, and he wanted that so badly his whole life. So it was really incredible to watch.
Rebecca Skloot is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. The book is this year's One Book, One Community selection for the University of Arkansas and the city of Fayetteville. During her visit to Northwest Arkansas, she's discussing the book to thousands of University of Arkansas students and delivering two public talks, one tonight beginning at 7 in the auditorium of the Donald W. Reynolds Center for Enterprise Development, and another tomorrow night at 7 in the Walker Community Room of the Fayetteville Public Library. The book is a finalist for the American Association for the Advancements of Science's 2010 Award for Excellence in Science Books. And the book will also be developed into a movie for HBO. I talked with Rebecca Skloot yesterday. It took Rebecca Skloot 10 years to finish her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and the work shows. There are wonderful details in the book we'd never know about if she hadn't taken all that time to research, write, and rewrite the book. But not all good things require so much time. In fact, we've started something today that is better if we spend less time on it. That's KUAF's fall fundraiser. The minute, the second we reach our goal of $140,000, we stop this fundraiser. We're trying to make this the shortest fundraiser ever, and you can help us do that right now. Here's how. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you for all your support of KUAF and for this daily edition of Ozarks at Large, now in its 12th week on KUAF. As we creep closer to Halloween, the opportunities to enjoy holiday-themed events grow. You have three more chances, beginning tomorrow night, to spend some quality, spooky time with three women in black in Bentonville. Ozarks at Large's Ithi Egnihotri Madolkar has this preview of Ghost Walks at Peel Mansion.
The 8th annual Ghost Walks will be hosted in Bentonville in the spirit of Halloween through the historical Bentonville Cemetery and the Peel Mansion. The mansion, according to Connie Hendricks-Kral, executive director of the Peel Compton Foundation, was built by Colonel Samuel West Peel in the year 1875.
Well, the Peel Mansion was actually built in 1875 by Colonel Samuel Peel, who was a colonel in the Confederate States of America, and settled his family and built the house that you see today. It's considered a prime example of what is known as the Italian villainate architectural style. He was also an Indian agent to the five civilized tribes in Oklahoma. His brother-in-law was governor of Arkansas, Governor James Berry, and he was a very active citizen in Bentonville at the time. He eventually became in poor health and moved out of the house, and it went through a series of different owners. And then in the late 80s, Walmart was considering building a supercenter, and they actually bought the acreage and the house and donated it to what would become the Peel House Foundation.
Since 2003, the enthusiastic Ghost Walks participants have been met by very special character artists at the Bentonville Cemetery who tell the stories of those who rest at historical grave sites, followed by a trip to the Peel Mansion.
One of the ways that we try to acquaint people with the history of not just Bentonville, but of the Ozarks, Northwest Arkansas, is through our 8th annual Ghost Walks. And it begins in the Bentonville Historical Cemetery, which is actually next to the Walmart corporate headquarters on Walton Boulevard. They're greeted by three, possibly four, grieving widows in black. The people that are there are divided into groups, and so, you know, it's staggered. And they're led to several different grave sites where they are told about the people that are resting there now. So it's quite a bit of history. Then after the last group, they all go over to Peel House, which is directly across the street. And this year they'll be greeted by someone who will be Mrs. Peel, Emmeline Peel, and she will be one of the leaders of the groups. And they'll be taking the upstairs, the downstairs. But the big highlight of the evening will be, backed by popular demand, the reenactment of the last public hanging in Benton County, which was 1876.
Ms. Hendricks-Kral does suggest that young children do not participate in the tour, as the Peel Mansion is rumored to be haunted. In fact, it is one of the 1,000 most haunted places in the United States.
There are people who have claimed to have seen Mrs. Peel or smelled her lavender perfume. There are people that have smelled Colonel Peel's cherry tobacco. And then they've also seen the young girl named Becky, who was a 7-year-old and was the daughter of a servant who died when she was young.
Ms. Hendricks-Kral has experienced some paranormal activities at the Peel Mansion herself, having smelled an odor that she couldn't explain. Her daughter claims to have been brushed on the staircase by the ghost of Becky. But apart from the thrill of a possible ghostly encounter, there are other attractions lined up too.
Well, I think it's a great evening if you have older kids. The dinner will be delicious, I can assure you that, because it's the caterer that we use. It's a lot of fun, I think, to be able to go into a cemetery in October and have people in character telling you about the people that are there. And it's just really interesting to find out, you know, what the history of this region was. And the house this year is actually going to be not a whole lot, but it's actually going to be, we're going to have some Halloween decorations. For instance, we're going to have a black mourning wreath on the front door.
For Ozarks at Large, this is Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Your next chance to experience the Ghost Walk at Peel Mansion is tomorrow night, with two more opportunities next week, Tuesday and Thursday night, the 26th and 28th. For more information, peelcompton.org. That's peelcompton.org. Later on this edition of Ozarks at Large, a trip up Mount Sequoia to find out what's happening there, and Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac. One thing we like to do on the daily edition of Ozarks at Large is keep you up to date on things that are happening over the next 24 hours. The League of Women Voters of Washington County will host a public forum on rising child poverty in Northwest Arkansas tonight from 6:30 until 8 at the Pat Walker Center for Seniors at 12 East Appleby Road in Fayetteville. If you'd like more information on the forum, you can go to the website lwvarwc.org. trumpetstudiorecital.org. And the University of Arkansas Fulbright College Department of Music features the Trumpet Studio Recital tonight, beginning at 7:30 in the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall of the Fine Arts Center. It's free and open to the public. For more information, music.uark.edu. We like to keep you up to date with what's happening in your neck of the woods, and here's an update on what's happening with the KUAF fundraiser. This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for all your support to make this the hopefully shortest ever fundraiser in KUAF history. You can do that with your phone call or online. One of Fayetteville's longest enduring and most recognizable landmarks is the cross on Mount Sequoia. Ozarks at Large's Ann Jarvis began a recent trip on Mount Sequoia near the cross, and she has this report on an upcoming event dedicated to the homes of and the retreat center on Mount Sequoia.
That's the rush of water falling on stone that greets visitors to the Asphalt Home on Skyline Drive in Fayetteville. If you've gone to the cross overlook on Mount Sequoia any time in the past 2 years or so, you've undoubtedly noticed the large home rising on the steep hillside beside it. Keela and Ray Asphalt will open the doors of their home to the public on Sunday, October 24th, as part of the first Mount Sequoia Autumn on the Mountain home tour. Stairs will lead you down from the street into the realm of the waterfall and to the front door. Inside, a huge metal panel, worked to look like a piece of elaborately pleated white satin, dominates the dining space. A second-story catwalk bisects the cathedral-like area of this great room. From under the catwalk, two steps take you down into the living area. Both ends of this space boast a triptych of 25-foot-high windows that flood the space with light at all times of day. The dining room has a view of the waterfall and its gardens. The living area looks out on a forest of native trees in summer, and in winter they offer a bird's-eye view of the town. Keela Asphalt says she and husband Ray spent a lot of time brainstorming before they brought their ideas to their architects, Brett and Stacy Park.
We went back and forth a lot for this site, wanting it to be something that we felt was really harmonious with where the house is situated. And we had a lot of ideas, and finally we decided something incorporating stone and wood and glass nestled in the forest, you know, among the trees would be our favorite idea, the thing we thought would most closely have the feeling that we wanted. And we wanted something that had a feeling of serenity.
Hammer and Chisel supplied the rock part of that vision. The most notable work is the 38,000-pound native stone fireplace that anchors the living area. Ray Asphalt says he had an idea that added even more weight.
And the mantle was taken from an oak tree right here on the lot. It's right out of the heart of the tree, 390-pound mantle.
Establishing a firm foundation for all that mass required special attention.
We were really astounded with what we were required to do to make this house secure on this lot. It's a steep lot. And they went down to bedrock, and then they cut keyways in the bedrock to lock the concrete walls into the bedrock.
The Asphalts didn't mind going to extremes to make their home a very special haven. The result is an open plan with extremely wonderful views on all three levels, extremely serene living spaces, and extremely inviting decks on three sides of the building. Thick walls provide extreme insulation, and there are unseen elements that also add to its extreme energy efficiency.
Our watering outside and supplying our waterfall and our watering of our grass and the hot tub, all that is produced by rainwater. We have 3,000-gallon cistern in under the basement, and we have solar lighting in the garden, and we have solar hot water panels on the roof.
For Keela Asphalt, trying to pick a favorite space in the house is almost as hard as trying to pick a favorite child. But when pressed, she has hers, the home's great room.
I love this room. I love to sit and have the feeling of having indoors and outdoors together. And I believe this is my favorite space right here.
The As Falls Fabulous Digs are just one of the homes included in the Autumn on the Mountain tour. The idea for the home tour came from Kim Ross, the Mount Sequoia Retreat Center's spiritual director. Her idea was to showcase the great variety of houses that exist in the neighborhood.
And so we have everything from a very lovely, charming cottage that's been pretty much completely redone to a brand new home or that's only a year old, and then a couple of established homes in between, one that has just an extraordinary garden that will be part of the tour.
On Sunday, when you check in at Parker Hall on the Retreat Center grounds, you'll get a map of the area with the homes marked. If you're in the mood for a walk, it's an easy jaunt around Skyline Drive, the road that circles the Retreat Center, to visit each one. As a bonus, the buildings on the grounds of the Retreat Center will also be open for touring. Some of the older ones date from the 1920s and offer the gracious feel of a bygone era. If you love to walk on Mount Sequoia like so many people do, Ross says there simply couldn't be a better time of the year to do it.
Come on Mount Sequoia, you're going to see amazing views, and we've scheduled this to be during the peak foliage season.
The beneficiary of all this fun will be the Retreat Center itself. Maintenance of the lovely older buildings hasn't been easy, even with an occasional influx of volunteer help. The older buildings need extensive work that just isn't in the annual budget. Bringing the facilities up to date isn't cheap.
Some of the work that we've done and still need to do is just pretty much the kind of, you know, going to the basic renovation, you know, whether it be wiring or plumbing, the kinds of things that just wear out over time.
Ross says many of the older buildings that add such grace to the historic retreat have multiple needs. She says the center is open to accepting any help offered.
If anybody is wanting to adopt a project, we have quite a variety of price ranges for those.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zan Jarvis.
Tickets for Sunday's Autumn on the Mountain home tour are available at the Mount Sequoia Retreat Center, Ozark Natural Foods in Fayetteville, or Bella Jack's Children Boutique. You can also pick them up at the Mount Sequoia table that will be at Saturday's Farmers Market on the Fayetteville Square. The tour on Sunday lasts from 1 until 5, and it also includes food and live music.
Three members of the rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd were killed in the crash of a chartered plane near Macomb, Mississippi, on this date in 1977. Lynyrd Skynyrd was an American rock band that rose to prominence during the Southern rock boom of the 1970s on the strength of its triple guitar attack and gritty working-class attitude. After playing under various names in Jacksonville, the group settled on Lynyrd Skynyrd, a backhanded compliment to a high school gym teacher notorious for his opposition to long hair. In 1973, they released their first album, called Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd. Freebird, a tribute to the late Duane Allman of the Allman Brothers Band, was an immediate sensation thanks to the interplay of its three lead guitars. Sweet Home Alabama, a response to Neil Young's Southern Man, opened the album, Second Helping, in 1974, and established the group as Southern Rock stalwarts. Following the plane crash in 1977, the group disbanded. Surviving members reunited in 1987, with Ronnie Van Zant's younger brother Johnny singing lead. The new Skynyrd was embraced by a number of country singers, especially Travis Tritt. In 2006, Lynyrd Skynyrd was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. On this date in 1945, Esther Bendersky, editor of the weekly Lepanto News Record for 34 years, had published in the Saturday Evening Post her story about a young Lepanto man, Staff Sergeant Jimi Hendrix, who won the Congressional Medal of Honor. She was also a skilled photographer. one of her nationally circulated news photos of a nun who survived a 1955 train wreck in Marked Tree, Arkansas, that killed five people, won a first place NFPW award, and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. In the first World Series game to be played outside the United States, the host Toronto Blue Jays beat the Atlanta Braves 3-2 on this date in 1992. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Still ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, today's edition of the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor. I'm Kyle Kellums. We're going to pause for just a couple of minutes in Ozarks at Large right now, though, because we are trying to conduct the shortest ever fundraiser in KUAF history. We got off to a great start this morning during Morning Edition, and then P.J. Hrabowski and John Jetter from the Fort Smith Symphony kept the momentum going. We'd like to keep that momentum continuing right now. As soon as we hit our goal of $140,000, this fundraiser is over. You can help right now if you haven't already. Here's how. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Arkansans can receive flu shots at low to no cost at locations in every county in the state beginning next week. The Arkansas Department of Health says over 800,000 Arkansans were given the vaccine last year, and few side effects were reported. Spokesman Ed Barham says officials are expecting another large crowd for flu shots this year.
We've ordered 600,000 doses, and the shot has three kinds of protection in it, H1N1, and a new kind of type A flu that we expect to see, and a type B flu that we think we'll see some of. So you're protected against the three kinds of flu that we believe we'll see this season.
Arkansans are asked to bring a copy of their insurance card to the clinic for billing purposes. However, there is no charge for those citizens of the state who happen to be uninsured. That's just about all the time we have for this edition of Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, October 20, 2010. This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Little Flock, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. The Friends of the Elkins Public Library will hold their fall book sale in the library's community room at 352 North Center Street in Elkins Friday and Saturday. Hours are 10 to 6 Friday, 10 to 2 Saturday. All materials priced at just 50 cents apiece. Book donations are accepted through tomorrow. If you'd like more information, you can call the Elkins Library at 643-2904. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks so much for your support of Ozarks at Large and KUAF. We're trying to make this the shortest ever fundraiser in KUAF history. You can help right now. Here's how.